Thank you, Your Honors. Rick Ruffner on behalf of the appellate. My registration number is 9163. I stand here about to give probably the briefest argument I've given in my 30 years at the Court of Appeals, but that's because the issue that we have brought before the court today is a fairly simple and straightforward in the sense of the issue itself. And so I don't intend to add much, if anything, to the briefs that I've already filed in the case on behalf of the appellant. But what I do want to make sure, and I want to make this as sure because of the answer brief that was filed in this matter, is what we're not here about. The appellant and the defendant is not here to object to the sanctions that were entered against him and for the entry of default pursuant to Rule 37. We're not here to argue that the court abused its discretion in entering a Rule 37 sanction against the defendant. Rather, we are only here disputing the court's denial of a continuance of the hearing on damages, which the court set and which the plaintiff requested in that case. As the court knows, the defendant was appearing pro se at the time of the default as well as the hearing for the damages, and approached this court with a request for continuance because of needed surgery on the date of the scheduled hearing, July 21st. The first time he requested that continuance, the matter was actually set for trial. He mentioned in the response to the motion for sanctions not only that he was scheduled for surgery, but also that he requested a continuance of that hearing because of the necessary surgery. The court entered the sanction of default against him shortly thereafter, but continued with the setting of the hearing. The defendant, again appearing pro se, asked the court for a continuance and attached thereto the report from his doctor, indicating that it would be critical to proceed with the scheduled surgical procedure to avert devastating results. Again, that was objected to by the plaintiffs, and the court, in two different rulings, denied the continuance and denied a stay of any proceedings. However, the court did not comment at any time as to its reasonings for denying the continuance. It simply denied it without any balancing as required by the Butler v. Farmer case, which we've cited in our briefs. So it's our position standing here today that the court abused its discretion by not granting the continuance and because it failed to make any findings as to why it should have or should have not granted the continuance. We believe that the court should have been required to do so. We especially believe the court should have been required to do so, given that in the response to the motions for continuance, there was no setting forth of any prejudice to plaintiffs by reason of the request for a continuance. Thus, it would have been appropriate for the court, as a matter of due process, to allow the continuance, a brief continuance, to enable the critical surgery to be obtained and to then hold an appropriate hearing on damages. There's only one reason that a hearing is set for damages. That is to allow proper due process for the setting of damages, and that simply did not occur in this case.
Counsel, let me ask you a question, if I may. Let's assume for just a moment that there had been no motion for continuance and that the hearing on damages proceeded as it was set. Given the nature of the sanction that had been imposed, would your client have been able to present any evidence at that hearing?
I certainly believe he could have participated by way of cross-examination and applied the rules of evidence and deal with the matter in that fashion.
Put plaintiff on strict proof, if you will.
Yes, because that's the only reason a hearing is required.
Okay.
Is because that still has to be done. And the Norton versus Raymond case, it's a 1971 Supreme Court case at 491 Pacific 2nd, 1403. It was a case relating to a default under Rule 55, but nevertheless, the court therein said that even in a default situation, the court must make sufficient findings to support a judgment for damages. And the whole purpose of that is to make sure that we do have damages proved under the rules of evidence. If that were not required, a party could simply submit a statement to the court of damages. It's not subject to any cross-examination, not subject to any validation, and the judgment would be entered. There's a purpose for the hearing, And that hearing is to make sure that the damages are properly proved in support of the default judgment.
Mr. Ruffner?
Yes.
The record doesn't indicate whether your client attempted to seek a stipulation from opposing counsel. And I'm a little surprised that with a representation that an attorney was going to undergo surgery, that a stipulation couldn't be reached. What's the reason for that?
I have no answer for that. I was not counsel at the time, and I would agree with the court that I see no indication in the record that a stipulation for continuance was sought. However, given the response to the request for a continuance that was filed, I think that that would have been futile.
Also, how much notice did your client have the trial? And I guess what I'm getting at, is there any evidence or that he could have had the surgery before or after the trial date that had been set?
I'll answer that in two parts. First of all, this trial date had actually been set for the actual trial for a period of many months. So the hearing date itself had been set. It converted to a hearing on damages after the default was entered. With regard to the medical condition, and again, it's not part of the record, so I hesitate to go too far into that, but he was suffering from a perforated hernia, which at his age of 74 at the time was a serious condition to the doctors. And the doctors were getting him in as soon as they could possibly get him in, and they did not want the delay.
How much time passed between the first request for continuance, which I understand was in essence combined with an answer to the request for sanctions, if you will?
Yes.
How much time expired between that date and the date set for the hearing? About.
That was filed on July 6th.
Okay, so for 15 days.
15 days. It was renewed then again on a motion dated July 16th, but I think the record shows it was actually filed on July 17th, along with the doctor's letter, as well as the scheduling order from the hospital for the admissions. I'll reserve the remainder of my time. Thank you.
James Marshall, on behalf of the appellee, Denise Genova, number 7438. Mr. Calvert had the opportunity to have counsel present and available to cross-examine Ms. Genova at the hearing held on July 21st, 2009. Current counsel entered his appearance on July 17th, or the Friday before that hearing, asked for a stay. When a stay wasn't granted, did not appear at the default judgment hearing to cross-examine Ms. Genova, inquire of her, dispute any of the evidence or the facts, all of which, if the court reviews the record, came from either a trial management order that Mr. Calvert stipulated to, exhibits provided by Mr. Calvert, and or the testimony of Ms. Genova. The question in this case for the court is, did the trial court abuse its discretion in denying the continuance? And in considering that, the court has to look at the totality of the facts in this case, according to the Supreme Court's decision in Lane versus Gooding, 63 Colorado 324, in determining whether this continuance was granted, or the request for extension or continuance was sought for the purpose of hindrance or delay. And when this court looks at the totality of the circumstances, understanding that Mr. Calvert was a licensed attorney who chose to represent himself pro se, the record shows a pattern of a refusal to follow court rules, refusal to follow court orders, which repeatedly resulted in delays and continuances of the trial. The complaint in this case was filed in May of 2006. Mr. Calvert didn't file his disclosures in this case until June of 2007, after he requested a 30-day extension, after the court entered an order to compel, after the court entered sanctions for failure to comply with the order.
Counsel, does any of that make any difference if, in fact, the statement from the doctor is true and accurate,
Well, that becomes a question. Whether, I think there are two questions with regard to the statement from the doctor. Number one, is it true and accurate? And number two, could this surgery have been held on at a different occasion?
Does the record indicate an answer to either of those questions?
No, the way the record transpired here is Mr. Calvert, the court ordered him to appear at a pretrial conference approximately a month before the trial. He failed to appear at the pretrial conference, which was, again, a refusal to comply with the court order. He was ordered to show cause why sanctions shouldn't be issued. In response to the motion to show cause, Mr. Calvert never asserted that he had any medical or health problems. He asserted several facts, which we detail in our brief, were simply not true. They were submitted in violation of Rule 11 with regard to health problems of his assistant, with regard to numerous issues, but no issue with regard to his health care was mentioned. When that motion for sanctions was granted, he then asked for a continuance of the trial and did not provide any medical documents, only saying that he had a health problem. He subsequently provided this doctor's report, but I think the doctor's report begs the first question, which is, this was the fourth time the case had been scheduled for trial. The trial had been scheduled since December of the previous year, 7 months earlier. Could this procedure have been scheduled 2 days later or a week before? There's no answer in the complaints or in the doctor's affidavit. The second issue is the doctor doesn't indicate what the problems are. Mr. Calvert is asking the court for the continuance. He doesn't provide, what he does provide is not adequate, and the court did not abuse its discretion, considering his conduct in the case, which included misrepresentations of fact to the court, misstatements of what was going on in the court, for the court to say, you don't have enough here for me to grant the continuance. The second issue goes to the harmless error, which there's a statement here that he had really no evidence to provide other than to cross-examine the plaintiff. He had counsel on the date of the hearing. Counsel chose not to appear. He had counsel previous to that hearing. That counsel chose to withdraw. The bottom line here is the prejudice to my client is she has been waiting 3 years to get to trial, and the trial was routinely continued and extended because of the defendant's conduct, which, when the trial court sits down and looks at it in its perspective of abuse of discretion, includes disobeying court orders, disobeying the rules, and not being candid with the court as to the realities and the facts in the case, including when he's asking that no sanctions be issued. So the trial court is faced with that dilemma. Understanding the context in which this case occurs, you have to decide whether the trial court abused its discretion with the facts in front of it. And I don't think there's any evidence that the trial court abused its discretion well, there's some evidence, but I don't think it rises to the level of overturning the trial court, that it's a clear abuse of discretion.
All the behavior that you describe, it was all sanctioned.
Well,
so by the time the judge is given the letter that says, "Hey, Judge, I'm going to have surgery," the malfeasance, it's all been taken care of, and your client's been made whole with respect to it because he's been fined, and he's also had a default entered against him. So at the time that the question is presented to the judge for purposes of determining discretion or not, the question is he going to have surgery or not? He's an officer of the court, he's a party, and he has a due process right to confront people against him at a hearing.
He's a party to the case, and as a party to the case, he's made untruthful statements to the court.
Well, we don't know that the letter regarding the surgery is untruthful.
We don't.
And as a matter of fact, as I read the record, the suggestion is that it's not legitimately disputed. You're not coming here today and disputing, are you, that in fact he had surgery scheduled for the date of the hearing?
I'm not disputing that he may have had surgery scheduled. To be honest, I've dealt with Mr. Calvert for 3 years, so I'm not sure. And I will be blunt with the court. The bottom line is, I'm not sure that that surgery only could have been scheduled on the 21st, the day that the trial in this case had been scheduled for 7 months, and that the trial couldn't have proceeded but for some emergency surgery. The cases cited by the defendant deal with the fact that during the course of the trial, somebody slips and falls, and that night they're hospitalized for 4 weeks. The day before the trial, the wife has, I think, a miscarriage. A few days before the trial, the defendant is arrested in a foreign country and can't post bail. The morning of the trial, the defendant calls and is sick. His lawyer's car breaks down and his lawyer can't get to court to get the continuance. There's no case decided with when you schedule, is this a discretionary surgery or not? You choose to schedule it, and we don't know whether that happened or not.
And Mr. Crucial, you ask good questions. I think the thing that is presented here is the question of whether the trial court should have also asked those questions.
I guess if Mr. Calvert would have appeared on the 15th or requested a hearing, the trial court could have asked those questions. He didn't, the 17th of June, when we had the pre-trial conference, which he was required to attend in person, and which he did not attend in person, nor did he call in on. Or we could have asked those questions if he would have requested a hearing. But none of those were done by him. The first request for an extension was done without any doctor's note. The second request, which was, and I think that it's interesting, almost 12 days later, has the doctor's note that this surgery has to be done on the 21st. So the question is, if you're asking for the continuance, he's a lawyer. We're not talking about a lay person. We're not talking about a party to the case. He's both in this case. He's representing himself and he's the party. He requests no hearing. He doesn't show up and indicate surgery is a required or an option. And we have, to be honest, a real problem with his candor throughout the entire case with the trial court. And I would say, do I believe the letter? I don't know what the doctor put in. Why he put it in or why he used the language he did, I don't know if Mr. Calvert typed the letter or transcribed it of the doctor. I don't know that. But this is the kind of case where, based upon 3 years of dealing, it's including, as we point out in the record, a representation that had been subpoenaed to the federal court to testify the matter, to continue a deposition when, in fact, we investigated he had not. That it calls into question that. And the question then is, did the trial court, with that knowledge, abuse its discretion?
Is it your contention, then, essentially, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, is it your contention, essentially, that based upon the history here, that the trial court did not abuse its discretion in denying the continuance because it had reason to suspect the legitimacy of the request?
That would be, and you can put those words in my mouth, because that is my position, that based upon the totality of the circumstances in this case and the facts as they play out in this case, in making a decision and in exercising its discretion, the trial court had to look at those facts. The medical report isn't provided at the first request, it's provided at the second request. It's Mr. Calvert doesn't show up, he doesn't ask for a hearing. There's prior evidence, and we think of failure to be candid with the court. At that point, I guess if I were Mr. Calvert's position, I would have said I want to have a telephonic hearing to establish that I have to have this surgery, it's an emergency, it wasn't scheduled prior to this trial. The purpose of having this surgery on this date, and I think this is the question, and I think there are two questions. Was this an unforeseen, an exceptional circumstance? Could Mr. Calvert, and that's the Valdez versus Pringle case, could Mr. Calvert have scheduled this surgery for some other time? so that this trial could have gone forward, so this case had been pending on the court's docket for more than 3 years to get resolved, or was the surgery scheduled for this date, legitimate or not, and was it necessary to be performed on this date for the purpose of hindrance or simply delaying the inevitable judgment which would occur in this case?
Thank you. The question that counsel just posed to the court, as well as the questions your honors have also posed, points to the very problem here. We don't know what the court was thinking. If the court had these concerns about the history of the case and that was the reason why she denied the continuance and she wanted to delve into those concerns in ruling upon the continuance, a brief hearing or status conference or something could have been called, or she could have set forth her reasoning in her rulings denying the continuance.
But counsel,
unfortunately, we're left, I'm sorry.
Counsel, to back up a little bit though.
Sure.
On the other hand, there was 7 months of notice of this trial or hearing date.
Correct.
Your client doesn't show up at the pretrial readiness conference, which was certainly an opportunity to have explained his position to the court and to have given the court a chance to ask those kinds of questions.
Not on the medical situation, because that occurred as an emergency situation. As I mentioned earlier, it's a perforated hernia, which came up and needs surgery with a restriction on traveling. So that wasn't even there to discuss on June 17th.
And then the following month, you filed an entry of appearance, but then did not turn around and show up at the hearing after it was denied. So you could have addressed the court's questions on that date too.
Sure, and I entered into an entry of appearance late the afternoon on July 20th, not July 17th. I think if you check both briefs as well as the record, it indicates the afternoon of July 20th. Given that the stay was not granted and given there's absolutely no way to effectively participate in a hearing without the assistance of a client, especially under these circumstances, it was futile to even attempt to attend a hearing. There wasn't going to be anything I could effectively do at that point without having the client there who knows the information and the evidence to be able to refute what the plaintiff is saying are her damages. Judge Criswell, do you have a question?
Well, I guess I was concerned about whose burden it is to establish that it was, in fact, an emergency. Now, the doctor's statement, as I read it,
right,
says it's serious and it's got to be done, but it does not indicate when it was discovered, nor does it even indicate, and of course we're dealing here with, I'm sure, some items of privacy, but what is the condition and why is it so necessary to have surgery in this particular day?
I would certainly concur that the pro se motion filed by Mr. Calvert was not artfully drafted, was not as full and complete as I would have liked to have seen. But the point is, he carried enough of his burden to establish that surgery was scheduled, absent of showing that he was committing perjury or filing a false pleading. Once that's done, if there are these questions, then, is this legitimate? Why does it have to be done now? Why can you not travel all the way to Pueblo for a hearing? And so on, should have been properly addressed before there's a ruling on the continuance. Instead, and I understand how the court, as well as counsel, have been frustrated with Mr. Calvert, but the court, I believe in its frustration, just simply said denied, given its history of dealing with him. That denied him his due process rights, albeit he certainly did not come before the court with clean hands. But nevertheless, he should have been afforded his due process rights to at least contest the evidence of damages. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, and thank you, counsel, for your arguments. The case will stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course.